We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Starting out, local and the state budget.
Yeah. News this week, the state budget got a much bigger hole in it than Gregoire and the last state legislature thought it should have.
Sucking wound is the...
is a better description. Yeah, there's going to be $1.4 billion drop in tax collections over the next 2 years, according to state economists. About that leaves about a $520 million hole in the current two-year budget. That still has about a year to run from October 1st through next June. Governor Gregoire said, well, okay, she issued an across-the-board cut of about 6.3%. Now, she could have done a couple things. She can't cut specific programs. She's not allowed to do that. She can issue an across-the-board cut, as she decided to do.
To be clear, if she cut specific programs, that would have to go through the state legislature.
Yeah,
special session.
Only the legislature can do that. And both she and the legislature have pretty much said, no, we're not going to do that this year. Or she could have decided to do nothing and let the legislature take care of it next January. But she didn't do that. She decided, well, let's put the cuts into place now. And that 6.3% across the board cut means that the biggest cut, $280 million, or about 54% of the total, is going to fall on the Department of Social and Health Services. And of that total, about $113 million is going to be cuts to health care for the poor, which is exactly what we were talking about when we were saying, you know, when the economy is going to be, is if the economy doesn't recover this year, the impact is going to fall the hardest on social and health services.
Yeah, and on the people who can least afford to, that need those services the most and can least afford to shoulder the burden themselves.
Yeah, another big cut in the state budget is $84 million to higher education. And of course, as we all know, that cut is not going to fall on the four-year universities. It's going to fall on the community colleges and technical schools. And what I want to point out here is that the community colleges and the technical schools, just like with money that goes to DSHS, really benefit the lower-income students. They don't benefit the students whose parents can afford to pay, you know, four-year tuition at the UW or WSU or the other four-year institutions in the state. So here we go, you know. I can't think of a better reason or a better argument for voting for the tax increase that's going to be on the ballot for wealthy Washington residents.
Yeah, Initiative 1098. Vote for it early and often.
All right. Anything else on the state budget woes?
Oh.
She just about covered it.
All right. Moving on then to developments at Seattle Center.
Yeah, the review panel that was charged with making a recommendation to the city came back yesterday with the decision selecting the new outlet mall from kitsch glass artist Dale Chihuly as its preferred use of the open space that will be in place after the Fun Forest goes away in another year or so.
At the Seattle Center?
At the Seattle Center.
I like to think of it as Seattle's Museum of Glass Envy.
Yeah, because there's already a similar outlet mall, museum down in Tacoma about 30 miles away.
Yeah, and actually the Museum of Glass in Tacoma is a really great place to visit.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's very. It's actually much better than the one here will be, I think.
But having a long display case for a massive number of Dale Chihuly glass art is apparently not enough
for us. We need a whole
museum devoted to his work.
Yeah, now we need to make a clear disclaimer here because there were several other competing applications for that space, and I'll talk a little bit about the process in a second. But one of those was for a new studio and performance space for KEXP. I just want to make very clear that, number one, I'm not an employee of KEXP, and I really have no dog in that fight. I mean, it would be nice to have that studio. It would be nice to have any of there were several very worthy applications for that space. The Chihuly one was not one of those. But I'm not speaking for anybody who's under the employee of KEXP. That said, the process was a farce. The city negotiated behind closed doors with the backers of the Chihuly Museum for a year and a half. When they announced the plan last spring, there was such a public outcry, both over the lack of public process and because it was, well, frankly, a stupid idea, that they went through this two-step dog and pony show of public hearings where they solicited different applications for the space. The KEXP studio was one of those. There was also a playground application. There were seven or eight different competing applications that made the final cut. But in the end, it turned out to be a sham because they went with the original recommendation for the Chihuly for-profit museum, surrounded by an 8-foot wall, as the best use of the last remaining open space downtown. That space could have been used for a children's facility. It could have been just used as an open space. It could have been used for any number of things. But it's really a shame and very indicative of the mentality of the city and of the, Parks Department and a number of the different departments in the city right now that public resources are seen primarily for their value as additional income streams. And that's what this is all about, is profits to the city.
Yeah, leaving aside any discussion of the merits of Dale Chihuly's art.
Yeah.
For those of us who are not his biggest fans.
Or even his medium-sized fans.
Or even his smallest fans.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, that's enough.
All right. Let's move on to Molly Norris. Who is Molly Norris?
Well, Molly Norris does better art than Dale Chihuly does. She's a local cartoonist who achieved some degree of notoriety early this year when she kind of inadvertently launched an internet phenomenon called Everybody Draw Muhammad Day, which I can get with that. I'm sitting here sketching a little picture of Muhammad even as we speak, that I'm holding up to the microphone here. It kind of loses a little bit of its power on radio, but you get the idea. But she, her editor at Seattle Weekly announced this week that she has had to go into hiding on recommendation of the FBI because of a fatwa that's been issued against her, ordering her death, by fundamentalist Muslim cleric. This is, number one, it's an abomination in its own right that this woman should have to, literally give up her life and give up her livelihood. It's sort of like witness protection, except that she has to pay for it herself. And she has to do this because of some nut job on the other side of the world. What's equally appalling is that this story has gotten virtually no attention from local media. It's been ignored by local TV. The Seattle Times had a perfunctory AP story on it. This should be something that generates a lot of concern and quite frankly, some outrage in local media, and it's gotten very little of that kind of attention at all. You would think that the first people to stand up for her would be other people in the media who understand what freedom of speech is all about, and that simply hasn't happened. It's kind of appalling.
All right. Moving on then to national and Census Bureau coming back with some stats.
Yeah, the Census Bureau released their statistics this week on the poverty rate in the United States. Apparently the poverty rate went up. Now, what was interesting to me is that I saw this reported two places this week. One was in the New York Times, where the headline read, "Recession raises poverty rate to a 15-year high." And the other was in the Financial Times, Britain's newspaper of record for businesses, kind of like their version of the Wall Street Journal. The Financial Times headline read, U.S. workers' poverty rate reaches 50-year high. So I asked myself, okay, wait a minute, which of these two is correct? Is it a 15-year high or is it a 50-year high? Well, the truth is that both are correct, and here's why. The New York Times counted the total number of people of all ages who fell below the poverty line, including children, and they reported it at 14.3% in 2009, the highest rate since 1994. So that's where they get the 15-year headline. The Financial Times reported that, but they went on to count the number of workers, that is, people aged 18 to 64 who fell below the poverty line. With the idea, of course, that workers are the folks most likely to be able to pull themselves up off, above the poverty line because they're the folks who can get a job and work and raise their income. And that rate was 12.9%, nearly 13%, the highest level since the early 1960s prior to Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. That's where they get the 50-year high. And when I looked at those two numbers, I thought, you know, there's some merit to the calculation that the Financial Times did, the British newspaper did, because it really is a measurement of how bad the recession is and how bad unemployment is in the United States and how that's a major contributor to poverty. But the New York Times neglected to report that number at all. And I thought that was very interesting.
And a number of U.S. media didn't report either one.
That's right. That's exactly right. And then of course, I looked, as usual, to see what the poverty level is these days. For a single adult, that's $10,830 in pre-tax income per year.
Which is insanely low.
Yeah, you can't even get a place to live on that pre-tax income. Remember, that's before you have any of your Social Security, Medicare, much less your federal income tax withheld from your check. For a family of four, it's $22,050 in pre-tax income. Again, insanely low for four people. And also among the statistics, too, there was an indication that the number of people below the poverty line would be higher if people weren't moving in with relatives to make ends meet. That increased by about 11.6% in the last 2 years, the number of multifamily households.
One of the other things that's worth pointing out about the definition of poverty and the fact that those levels are so low is that when you're comparing it to, you know, levels 15 years ago or 50 years ago, what is defined as poverty has been redefined lower and lower over the past 50 years, so that what was considered impoverished as a percentage of, say, what the median income is much lower now than it was 15 or especially 50 years ago.
Well, and also it doesn't take into account regional differences. So someone in the Midwest, a single person trying to live on $10,000 or so dollars a year, might be able to make ends meet because their housing might be cheap enough and they might be able to go down to the food bank and still be able to afford utilities and occasionally some clothes at the local used clothing store. However, someone here in the city of Seattle, $10,000 won't even get you a one-bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
Or even a studio apartment in most neighborhoods.
Yeah, similarly, there are places in this country, and Seattle is not one of them, where the cost of heating oil or the cost of utilities during the winter is exorbitantly high, or the cost of, you know,
those regional differences make a difference as well, but that's not figured into a single number like that that's meant to cover the entire United States. I also want to point out, too, that the total number of Americans below the poverty line then is now about 44 million. And that in addition to the mom and dad safety net of, yes, you can move back home if you can't afford the rent, unemployment benefits kept an additional 3 million Americans above the poverty line. But again, that's only temporary because there's a limit on your unemployment benefits. And once that limit runs out, too bad.
All right. Well, from that happy news on to developments with free trade.
Oh, yeah. A very interesting report from Public Citizen this week. They issued a report showing that the impact of free trade agreements on U.S. exports over the last 12 years is not what you would necessarily expect. Our exports to the 17 countries that we have free trade agreements with grew at a slower pace than our exports to all other countries. And when trade fell worldwide as part of the recession, our trade with those same 17 countries that we have free trade agreements with fell at a higher rate than it fell with others. Now, free trade and trade and the trade deficit the number of exports can depend on a lot of different factors, not necessarily the terms of a free trade agreement. However, when you look at all of the countries together in a group and you see as a group that it's sort of underperforming the average or underperforming the expectations, then you might have to ask yourself, there may be something seriously wrong with this notion of free trade agreements or with the types of free trade agreements that our political representatives have negotiated on behalf of the United States and the U.S. public. And that's not to mention, of course, the fact that most free trade agreements don't include worker or environmental protections.
So if that was like for your IRA or 401k, if that was a specific grouping there, the free trade
Free trade agreement.
Yeah.
What has its performance over the past 12 years been? Well, you would be ditching that stock really quick.
Yeah. And by the way, combining the last couple of items, there's also a very good series recently in, I believe it was Slate, the online magazine, looking at income inequality in the United States and how it is actually now equal or exceeding the income inequality in a lot of Latin American countries and countries that we have some of those free trade agreements with, not because we're as poor as those countries, but because the wealthy are so much wealthier, plus the bottom has fallen out of the middle class here. And free trade agreements have a piece of that, along with many other factors, of course.
All right. So this week, I think we saw the last of the primaries.
That's
here
correct.
For the U.S.?
Yeah, we're on to the general election. And there was one consistent theme through the half a dozen or so different states where primaries were held this week, which is that every ballot on which a truly lunatic Republican was running, they pretty much all won in the Republican primaries. So that you have 37 Republican nominees in these different states running for the U.S. Senate. And just as a measure of how radical the Republican Party has become, every single one of those 37 Republican nominees denies the science behind climate change. Every single one, even incumbents like John McCain and Paul Kirk of Illinois, who have in the past supported climate change action, are now opposed to it. You now have five different nominees: Rand Paul of Kentucky, Ken Buck in Colorado, Joe Miller in Alaska, Sherrod Angle in Nevada, and now Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, who oppose abortion and reproductive rights, even in the case of rape and incest. So that you have the strong possibility, because three of those five are actually even are ahead in their polling right now, you have the strong possibility of a pro-rape, pro-incest lobby in the Senate come January. It really is a measure of how crazy the Republican Party has become. And a couple of things I want to mention about that. One is that the danger isn't just that these folks might win their races, although particularly with the Senate, given its 6 years terms and the ability of even one senator to cause gridlock by obstructing the passage of a legislation they don't like. And a lot of these people are philosophically opposed to government, period, and can be expected to try and stop any legislation just because it's legislation. So that's bad enough that they might be holding their individual seats. But the real danger is that when you have one of the two major political parties, and particularly when it's the political party that's out of power during bad economic times, where if you want an alternative to the guys who are in power and women who are in power now, that's the only practical alternative that's really on offer. So there's a danger they get elected, but the real danger is that this redefines normal. That when you have an extreme position like denying abortion, even in the case of rape and incest, that was, 10 years ago, that was a wholly unreasonable, absolutely politically unfathomable position to take. Now it's he said, she said in media coverage of it, because you have important people in D.C. who advocate this position. So it becomes a cultural shift, and it's a slippery slope that we've been going down for the last 30 years or so, where what gets defined as normal and political discourse gets more and more and more reactionary. That's what we're seeing as a result of some of these Tea Party wins in these different primaries. The other danger is, I think, a lot of complacency on the left, where a lot of people are quite justifiably upset with President Obama and what some of the Democrats have done, and the fact that they haven't fought for a lot of the more progressive initiative that a lot of people feel really need to take place to get us out of our economic malaise and stop the wars and all the various other critical issues that are going on. We got a bigger problem. Because if these folks take power, we're gonna look back on the good old days when,
Bush was in office.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of these people make George W. Bush look like an elder statesman, and an intelligent one at that. It really is quite frightening. So, I really think, as abominable as some of the Democratic policies have been, it really is a time, unfortunately, when lesser of two evils carries a lot of weight, because one of those evils is really, really evil.
But clarify, when you say the Republican Party, a bunch of these people who have won
pushed out people who had been stalwarts of a more conservative Republican Party.
Yeah, the actual national leadership of the Republican Party is really appalled by a lot of these developments. They don't have control over the nomination process at this point. This has become in many ways a real grassroots phenomenon. The big money Republicans in D.C. and New York really are pretty uncomfortable with, and so there's a lot of sort of internecine warfare going on within the Republican Party right now, but that does not negate the fact that these people are the nominees, and then that in several cases, you know, Rand Paul is ahead in the polls. Joe Miller in Alaska is ahead in the polls, even though Lisa Murkowski has now announced that she's going to run a write-in campaign. Sharon Angle is within the margin of error of beating Harry Reid in Nevada. These people stand a real chance of getting elected, and they very much are influencing the political discourse and how political issues get covered in the media.
And then in terms of money that's going into these campaigns, have you seen it seems like a lot of the people who have won were outspent significantly by the more traditional candidates?
Yeah, and a lot of these primaries have been very low turnout affairs too, where you can get a really small motivated base, getting the more extreme candidates into power. So some of these folks, like in the case of Delaware, for example, and Christine O'Donnell, the incumbent or the representative that she beat the more moderate Republican Mike Castle, was widely expected to be favored going into the general election. Instead of that seat leaning strongly Republican, now it looks like the Democrat is going to be heavily favored in that race instead. So the Democrats are likely to win a few races that they otherwise would have lost because of these radical nominees, but they're not going to win them all. And as I said, in the meantime, the influence on the discourse is the real long-term danger here, because it makes outrageous ideas seem palatable.
Or just the danger of having one extremely radical right-wing senator in the Senate who will block everything.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on then to international, starting with Afghanistan.
Yeah, today the nation of Afghanistan is undergoing parliamentary elections during a time when the security situation in Afghanistan is at its worst since the invasion in 2001. For years, the Taliban was active in only about 4 or 5 provinces in Afghanistan, and now they're active in 34 out of 35 total provinces in the nation. Many polling places have been closed, at least 1,000, probably more than that, because of the security situation. Less than half the number of international observers that were on hand for last year's presidential election will be on hand for this year's, and they will only be able to go to provincial capitals, not to the rural areas where most of the population of Afghanistan lives.
Back mm-hmm. up just a second here. I can remember a few years ago when we were holding parliamentary elections, not national prime minister elections, in Iraq. And the U.S. government was crowing about how this was a new day for democracy, and we were bringing democracy and enlightenment to a part of the world that had not experienced that before, and that this was one of the things that our occupation had resulted in a great triumph. You know, the people holding up their blue thumbs and or purple thumbs and all this sort of thing. I'm not hearing any of that kind of coverage of the Afghanistan elections.
That's because they expect it to be widely fraudulent. Last year, there was rampant fraud in the presidential election with vote buying and ballot stuffing, and that all led to tossing out at least 1 million ballots, probably more than that should have been tossed out. And this year, there are reports of massive vote buying in rural areas, everything from paying people to go to the polls to vote for a candidate to actually buying their cards to give to your supporters to use their registration cards to use to vote for them to buying up a whole village so that the village elder can then direct everybody on who to vote for. Just massive amounts of vote buying. So nobody in the Western press, nobody in the U.S. government, nobody in Afghanistan, nobody thinks this is going to be a fair election. Meanwhile, in the Obama administration, they're considering ways of dealing with the corruption problem in Afghanistan. They had a big meeting this week, a big 2-hour meeting in the White House, and they're considering making Hamid Karzai their main partner in corruption investigations.
Sorry.
This is to evidently to avoid any kind of surprise arrests of his cabinet ministers, which has led to a lot of conflict between the U.S. and Hamid Karzai in the past. And the U.S. is turning its focus on what it thinks of as egregious corruption. And I just want to quote what one American official said after the meeting. He said, quote, "That means going after officials who abuse ordinary Afghans and drive them to the other side, a plundering landlord or a brutal thieving cop," end quote.
And I have this vision of asking Al Capone to help with stopping rum running.
Right. And yeah, while those little guys can be a problem, you know, people don't like a thieving cop or a plundering landlord. The U.S. isn't going to touch the more routine kickbacks and bribes that grease the Afghan political system. And that is, as Job said, that's exactly what's at the root of the corruption problem in Afghanistan. Literally, what you're seeing is a U.S. attitude of, oh, we'll pick up a couple of the drug dealers on the street, but when it comes to their distributor, their supplier, we'll pat them on the back and say, yes, we support you 100%. In fact, we want you to help us be in charge of our anti-drug program. That's literally what this is the equivalent of.
Yeah, or asking your local serial killer to help with your anti-littering campaign.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane policy.
All right. And The Guardian this week?
Yeah, The Guardian this week, 12 American soldiers facing charges over a secret kill team that allegedly blew up and shot Afghan civilians at random and collected their fingers as trophies. Five of the soldiers charged with murdering three Afghan men, allegedly killed for sport in separate attacks this year. Seven others are accused of covering up the killings and assaulting a recruit who exposed the murders when he reported other abuses, including members of the unit smoking hashish stolen from civilians. And we wonder why we're not winning hearts and minds.
And some of these guys were members of a striker brigade based out of Fort Lewis, right?
That is absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm.
And then briefly, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Ali Ahmad Asseri is a diplomat, the first secretary of the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles, and he's seeking political asylum in the United States. He's informed the Department of Homeland Security officials that Saudi officials have refused to renew his diplomatic passport, essentially terminating his job after discovering that he was gay and, even worse, was close friends with a Jewish woman. He's seeking asylum in the U.S., afraid that he is rightfully so, that he fears for his life. Unfortunately, the Obama administration is about to propose a record arms deal worth many billions of dollars with Saudi Arabia, so chances are we're simply going to sacrifice this guy. It's too bad that Mr. Asseri isn't Iranian, or we'd be hearing all about this in the media.
All right. Events.
This afternoon, speaking of Fort Lewis, between 2 and 4 o'clock, Bradley Manning, the GI who allegedly leaked a number of sensitive documents on the Afghan war to, and very damning documents on the Afghan war to WikiLeaks, he's now in a gulag somewhere, probably getting the crap tortured out of him. He's there's going to be a support rally for him this afternoon from 2 to 4 o'clock at the north gate of Fort Lewis off exit 122 of Interstate 5. And then Tuesday is the United Nations International Day of Peace. There will be a number of observations of that both this weekend and on Tuesday. We'll have a lot of the details of that in our activist calendar listing on the Eat the State website. So check that out. There are much more extensive calendar listings now with a lot of good events that are happening in and around town.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
That calendar is at that website, which is www.eatthestate.org. And there's a blog there and a lot of good articles and an activist calendar. And go on and check it out. It's a lot of good information. www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, drop us a line at editorial@eatthestate.org.